Hello, and welcome to the podcast for Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This is the message given on Sunday morning, July 14th, 2013, by Tom Job, from the book of John, chapter 6.
I wanted to read to you guys out of, for the last several weeks, and maybe just like for a little bit more, I wanted to look at some verses that are like different places in the Gospels where it talks about Jesus eating food with people because it was super important, and you learn a lot from people that he ate with and stuff that happened and things that he said, and this is another one. The Gospel of John, chapter 6. It said, sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. And Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples, and the Jewish Passover feast was near. And Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd of people coming towards him and said to Philip, where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? And he asked this only to test him because he already had in mind what he was going to do. And Philip answered, 8 months' wages would not be enough bread for each person to have a bite. And another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. Here's a little boy that has 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish. But how far is that going to go among so many? And Jesus said, have the people sit down. And there was plenty of grass in that place. And the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. And then Jesus took the loaves and he gave thanks and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. And he did the same with the fish. And when the other gospels say that like it was 5,000 men, not including the women and kids. So, I mean, this was like a complete total ton of people. So maybe like 10 or 15,000 people. And when they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, gather the pieces that are left over because nothing should be wasted. And so they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. And after the people saw this miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world. Lord God, I do ask you, there's a reason why this story is in here. And it has to do with us. And it has to do with people in here that are tired. And anyway, I just ask you to help us understand it. And understand what we're supposed to get out of it. And especially for someone here, it might be the key to their emotional and mental recovery. Help us in Jesus' name. Amen. You know, I saw this thing on the I guess it was on the news on Friday, but there was in Central Park in downtown Knoxville, they had this thing where they had these parking lots. Maybe y'all saw this, and they had these big signs that say public parking, and then they have this other little sign that you can't read as well, and the writing is really, really little, and it says you have to pay your money, and if you don't, you have to pay, you'll be fined and towed away at your own expense and all that stuff. And people think it's public parking, and they think it's free parking, and then they've been getting those, like, metal boots on their thing, on their wheels, and it takes $75 a thing to get those off so you can go anywhere. And people are kind of upset because they're like, you put this public parking in big letters and then tiny little letters. It's not, like, free public parking. And it made me think about this when Mark Twain, when he started, he was a correspondent for a San Francisco newspaper, and he had gone to Hawaii to write these articles. They called them the Sandwich Islands then. And when he came back, he didn't realize this, but he had become really kind of famous because people thought he was hilarious. And so he was going to give lectures. And he did this his whole life, especially when he needed money, is he would rent, you know, people used to do this like Charles Dickens and Herman Melville and stuff, and they would rent a big opera house and give a lecture and try to get people to come to it and pay money and hear him talk about the Sandwich Islands. And he had this poster that he made, and he put it all over town, the Sandwich Islands, Mark Twain lecture, on the Sandwich Islands, and then it says in big letters, a splendid orchestra. And then in little letters, is in town but will not be playing. And then it had a den of ferocious wild beasts, and in little letters, will be on exhibition in the block, in the next block over. And then it said, magnificent fireworks. And then in little letters, we're in contemplation for this event, but the idea has been abandoned. And then it said, a great torchlight procession. And then in little letters, it said, may be expected. In fact, the public is privileged to expect whatever they want. But, and then it says, doors open at 7, the trouble begins at 8. And he did that his whole life. And he told stories. And he went all over the country. And he wound up going all over the world on different occasions, telling the same stories about all different things. Like his trip west, when he left Hannibal, Missouri, and went to San Francisco, and got in San Francisco, and he had a really bad cold, and he was staying at a hotel, and the lady that worked at the desk at the hotel told him, what you should do is drink a quart of whiskey in the next 24 hours, and you'll feel better. And he told that to a guy that he had met there that he was having dinner with, and the guy said, that's very good advice. I think you should do that. Just drink a quart of whiskey in the next 24 hours. And he said, I did it, and it was really hard the next day because I took both of their advice, and that's a half a gallon. And and he talked about smoking, and he smoked 40 cigars a day. But he said, I could quit anytime I want. He said, I've done it 1,000 times. But what he told about this one lady, she had lumbago, and he said, this old lady, and he said, what you should do is quit smoking for 2 days, quit smoking and drinking and cussing, and your lumbago will get so bored it'll just leave your body. And she said, well, I have never done any of those things. And he said, well, there you go. You've neglected your habits. He said, you're like a sinking ship and you don't have any cargo to throw overboard. But he talked about when he went to he talked about the missionaries that went to the Sandwich Islands and how all the women on the Sandwich Islands, they didn't wear anything at all except those flowered necklaces around their necks, and how the missionaries had never, they had never talked about that in seminary. What do you do when you go to church and the whole congregation is dressed like Adam and Eve? He said some of those young missionaries had a hard time keeping their eye on the text as they were reading it. But he went around. He told those same stories everywhere he went all the time. There was a woman that a lot of you know about named Corrie ten Boom. And she and her sister had been involved in the Underground Railroad to help Jewish people escape from Holland, and they wound up being busted and sent to the local prison and then two concentration camps. And she went, after that, she traveled all over the world from like 1946 until she had a stroke, I think, in the 90s. But she went all over the world telling her stories, and she used to tell a story about a woman about when she was first giving a lecture in a church about what God did during that time, and how a man came up and she recognized him as one of the guards in the concentration camp that she was in. And he came up to her and said, Fraulein, it's so amazing to hear what God has done. And she just was filled up with hatred to this person in her heart. And he said, I too have come to know Jesus. And he stuck out his hand and said, could you forgive me for all that I did? And she said she tried to lift her hand up and she couldn't, to forgive him and shake his hand. And she said, Jesus, you're going to have to do this for me. And she felt like an electrical charge go down her arm, and her arm just lifted up and she shook his hand and said, I forgive you. And she said she just felt like her heart be set completely free from doing that. And a woman who traveled with her for about the last 13 years of her life, kind of her attendant and her helper, said, I heard her speak thousands of times. Everywhere around the world, every place that she spoke, she never failed to not tell that same story. She told it everywhere in exactly the same way. And, you know, I was just thinking about, I mean, I was thinking about that myself, because sometimes I think I probably bore you guys with stories I tell about, like, when we were missionaries in Italy, and it makes me nervous to think I keep telling those stories. Lee said we always can tell who visitors are here because they laugh at my jokes, because everybody else has heard them like 20 times. But And I don't mean to do that stuff, but it was a time in my life that I learned a lot of things. I learned a lot of things that I know. I don't know what it means when a person tells the same story over and over again, except it's important to me, I guess, and there's things that I want to tell you. There's probably like 30 different miracles in the four Gospels put together that are described that Jesus did. John said in chapter 21 of his Gospel that Jesus did like so many miracles that aren't written down that the world itself couldn't hold the books that to contain them. But there probably are 30 individual ones described. And in some of the Gospels, one of the Gospels will tell one. Like the Star of Bethlehem, the story of the Star of Bethlehem, that's only in the Gospel of Matthew and the wise men who came from the east. That's only in Matthew. The story of angels singing to shepherds on the night that our Lord was born, that's only in the Gospel of Luke. And the story of Lazarus being raised from the dead is only in the Gospel of John. There is only one miracle that Jesus did that is told in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it's the one we just read about how Jesus made miraculous food for all these people. And you kind of get the impression that it's super important. And there are lessons, there's something in that story that we've got to understand, or else there are people, a person is going to, especially people who want to do something for God. Like they want to do. This was right in the Gospel of Mark. We find out that this thing happened right after a really important transition had taken place in these guys that were following Jesus around. In fact, they were called up to this point followers. They were disciples and like following Jesus. And then for the very first time, it uses the word apostle, which apostle means. It's the Greek word for the Latin word missionary. It means to be sent. That Jesus, without him going, he sent them out to do stuff for him, like amazing stuff that they could have never done before. And that happened right before this thing. And it's almost like the idea is for people who want to do stuff for God, while we still have a chance in this world to do something for him, there's something super important in this story that you have to understand if you're not going to wind up an emotional wreck, completely broken down by the side of the road. There's some stuff you're going to have to understand, or this whole thing about like getting God to use me and giving me stuff to do, it will crush me. I mean, it seems real cute and everything, but once you get into it, it will crush you if you don't understand some stuff. I mean, these guys had just come back from their first, like, I guess, short-term mission trip or whatever. And they were pumped and they were pooped. I mean, they were super tired. And Jesus had said to him, okay, guys, let's go somewhere, like go away and have some time just together, just us, and time to kind of reflect and debrief and also to get some rest. I mean, because you guys are tired. And so they went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which in a boat, you know, they say it's like 4 miles, but walking it was 8 miles. But there were all these people who found out that that's where Jesus was. So like thousands of people, like, you know, little kids running, men and women, babies, people carrying their babies on their back. Probably people carrying like really old people on their piggybacking them on their back because they had to get to him. And it wasn't like when Jesus came into Jerusalem in the triumphal entry or whatever, where everybody was just like praising him and saying, we want you to be our king. It was people who were super needy and everybody needed something. And that's why they were there. And when the disciple, you know, Jesus' followers, when they saw like all these thousands of people were coming and they're like, oh, crud. I mean, I really need some me time. And we've been doing this stuff. And we're tired. And here were all these people. It was about, it says in the other Gospels that Jesus had them all sit down and he just taught them a lot of stuff that they needed to know. And then when it got to be about sunset, which this was about mid-April, and the sun sets over there in mid-April about 7:30, and you couldn't even hear Jesus anymore for the babies crying and the stomachs growling because nobody had anything to eat. And Jesus said, where are we going to get food to feed these people? I mean, this is a big problem. And his guys were like, yeah, this is a big problem. And I did not want this right now. I think that one thing that Jesus wanted them to know was it is always going to be this way. We are going to sail to heaven on a sea of neediness. There's always going to be needs everywhere. I mean, like, endless needs all the time. I think about like a young mom, you know, and waking up in the morning next to, you know, that thing over there beside her in the bed with his mouth wide open, and just, that dude is going to need encouragement, love. He's going to have to face temptations that day. He's super needy. And she goes downstairs, and behind the cereal boxes are her little sleepies, and they're going to need food and sandwiches and money for lunch and love and encouragement and clothes and more milk and college fund, and there's no end to what they need. And then she goes to work, and there are people there that work with her, and they don't know Jesus. And if they die that way, they are going to be lost forever and ever and ever. And in Acts chapter 17, it says that God has put everybody, he has determined what time and the boundaries of where people live so that they could somehow feel for him. And so here are these people there at this time working there and somehow feeling for God, and you know something that they desperately need to know, and you don't know how to talk about it or how to tell them, or but it's the greatest need of all. And we live in a world, if you're talking about that, where the whole world is full of people who don't know anything about Jesus. In the country of Bangladesh, if you had 1,000 random people, 4 of them believe in Jesus. In Bosnia, out of 1,000 people, 1 of them believes in Jesus. In Mauritania, on the coast of Western Africa, out of 1,000 people, 1 of those people believes in Jesus. 1 in 1,000. And all over the world, it's like that. And not only that, but people are hungry everywhere. The lowest billion people in the world live on 23 cents a day. Half the world lives on, per person, $2 a day. The average American lives on $70 a day. Every 16 seconds, somebody dies of starvation in our world. 10 million children will die this year because of preventable diseases. And 143 million children in the world are orphans. And it's just... And Jesus knows about it. I mean, he knows why he's allowed it. He knows every tear that falls in every heart and why he's allowed it to be this way. And he could do something about it, but... And he is using it, and in ways that we'll never understand in this world, of why this world is in so much pain and need and what's coming out of it and what he's going to do in it and through it and for it all. But in the meantime, he weeps over it, like when Lazarus was dead and he went to his cemetery and everybody was crying, and he didn't like, guys, this is about to become the greatest party of all time. Like, stop your crying. Knowing that in a few minutes he was going to make it like that, he just wept, because it's just so much hurt in our world. And it's basically, okay, that is the way it's going to be. We live in a bottomless world of bottomless need. If a person expected it to be anything else other than that, you're going to be so frustrated. You know, like, if you think, well, come on, people. Like, you know, they were, come on, people, you could have brought some food. Why didn't anybody think of that? Hello? Doesn't it happen every day at this time that somebody gets hungry? Why didn't y'all think about that? This isn't my responsibility. It's just like, get it together. Come on, Haiti. Get it together, Haiti. Why are you people like that? Why can't you get it together? They can't get it together. It's too complicated and too deep. And you know, they could have felt like, we've done our stuff. We've done a lot of stuff. And we're tired. It's time for us to rest. Why did you all people have to come? And it's like thousands of hungry people. If I hadn't been following Jesus, I wouldn't be in this mess right now. Like, following Jesus kind of make my life worse. If a person doesn't expect it to be this way, that it's going to be bottomless need. And you can wind up saying, I just hate this old needy world. I hate all their needs. Everybody has the needs. You know? And then you think, and there's a place in your heart where the Holy Spirit lives that you know, but I'm not allowed to protect myself and to hide and to pretend it isn't out there, because if I live to protect myself from all this need and I'm just going to take care of me and not think about it and not help anybody, you know that there's a place inside of you that's going to shrivel up, and so you can't really do that. So that's an important thing to know, that it's always going to be like this until Jesus comes back. We live in a world of endless need, and it's everywhere. And so he said to them, so what do y'all have? Okay, there's like all these. And it turned out that what they had was really kind of a joke. I mean, if we put together it would take 8, Philip said, you know, about $12,000 to give these people, everybody, something. And if we did that, if we took everything we had and put it together, there wouldn't be anything left for us. That's right. I think it's super important to understand, I am never going to have enough to meet the needs that are around me. If I even, you know, we have like 5 loaves of bread, 2 fish. That's kind of a joke when you think about it. I don't have enough for the needs that are in my personal life, for the people in my life. When I think about, and you know, there are some pastors who give you the impression that if they have a vision for how we're going to organize people and organize the resources to meet this gigantic need, it's a joke. We don't have what it takes to meet the needs that are in our life that people have. Or the need, we just don't have it. We don't have enough. And like when the guys go to Chicago tomorrow, and on Tuesday, they are going to have an awesome day. And they're going to have an awesome Tuesday night, helping and encouraging people who are trying to help people who are coming out of gangs and prisons, and loving on guys and men and women that have come out of gangs and prisons. And they're going to go back home to their hotel at the end of Tuesday saying, that was one of the greatest days of my year, maybe the greatest day of my life. That was awesome. And another feeling that they're going to have as they drive through the streets of Chicago. They drive through the worst streets in America, and they see people that are beaten down and houses that are beaten down and babies growing up in families where there's gunfire and drugs and everything, and it's block after block after block after block, and they're going to go home feeling like what we did today was nothing. This thing never ends. Nobody has enough to meet the needs that I see. Nobody has enough money. Nobody has enough time. Nobody has enough energy. Nobody has enough love. I remember when we were missionaries in Italy, and we had been doing a lot of sharing Jesus, like out in the streets and big squares, and it's kind of a different world. And you could get like hundreds of people to listen to the message of Jesus, and a lot of people came to know him. And we had three guys that came to know Jesus, and they got an apartment together, and it was kind of like three to five guys at a time living together and growing. And one night we were out sharing Jesus in a big crowd of people late one night in the middle of Milan, and a guy came up and he prayed, and it turned out he was a childhood friend from Sicily of one of our guys that had accepted Jesus, who was also from Sicily. And this guy was a heroin addict. And he accepted Jesus, he's a sweet guy. They took him into their apartment, and we all helped him just for days as he sweat and shook and tried to get heroin out of his system. And we spent nights and took turns and just everybody giving everything so that Nicola could just really, really be set free. And he was. And he was so different and so sweet. And he was living with them. And then about a week later, they came home and he was gone and stolen everything that they had. And it's just like, you know, the only person, and that's just one person, the only one who has enough time, money, energy, and love is Jesus to meet the needs of this world. And there was one person who believed that. It was a guy named Andrew. And every time you see Andrew in the Gospel of John, he's bringing somebody to Jesus. In the first chapter, it was his brother. And people thought, your brother is hopelessly obnoxious. And he just knew, I know that, but with Jesus, it's not hopeless. I mean, I'm learning things about him. And what we think that was hopeless with him, it isn't. There's a place in chapter 12 where there were some guys that were like not Jewish people. They were foreigners. And they wanted to know about Jesus. And he took them to Jesus. And other people were like, these people are hopeless. They're hopelessly unorthodox. And he's like, but for Jesus, it's not hopeless somehow. There was a little boy, and I don't know how he got this little boy to give his lunch up, but I mean, he maybe promised that Jesus would autograph his lunch bag or something like that. But it's just like, this situation is hopeless. But he's like, but with Jesus, I'm learning that when stuff is like hopeless, like one time there was like Lazarus, when he was dead, when he was dead, and they had sent for Jesus, and Andrew was kind of like, I kind of get the feeling that he waits until things get hopeless. And then he does something. This guy named Jairus, they went to get Jesus because his daughter was dying. And Jesus was coming and stopped and talked to someone until the little girl was dead. Now it's hopeless. And then he did something. And Andrew is like, he has something. He knows something that I don't. He has something that I haven't. And he can do things that I can't. And this isn't hopeless. And so what I have, it might be a joke. It might be so stupid to even bring this. But he's asking me. And I'm going to bring it to him. This is all we had. And, you know, I think a person feels like, you know, the needs around me, the needs I know about, let alone the ones I don't even think about in the world, like they're endless. And I don't have it's a joke what I have to meet the needs that are all around me. But he says, what do you have? And okay, it might be stupid. You know what I've got? I've got myself. I've got me. That is almost nothing. You know, that's almost nothing. But, when we were in seminary, in January 1980, that's when I started, and I took a class in an introduction to world missions. And they talked about countries where people don't know Jesus. And I didn't know that. Like, what? There are countries where people don't know Jesus? Oh, yeah, tons of them. I was like, why didn't anybody tell me that? And then they were talking about the needs for people to go, and I don't know. I wanted to do something with my life, okay. It's a joke, really, but here I am. I think that God is waiting and pushing for a person to say, in this endless world of endless needs, having something that's really pretty much a joke to you, that just all I have is myself, but he's waiting for people to say, but I'm in. I want to do something. I want to be a part of this. I know it looks ridiculous, but I want to be a part. I think that God is waiting for people to say that to him. And some people like, I don't know what to do. I just feel like if a person were to say to God every day for 30 days, for 90 days, say to God, I don't know what to do, but I'm giving myself to you. Use me somewhere. Give me somebody to love. I don't know who or where. And I know it's ridiculous in the light of the needs that they're in kind of a joke. But I want to do something. Take me. Use me. I guarantee you. I don't know what would happen if a person would say it, but in the light of, I know it's ridiculous, in the light of all, but here I am. Would you do something with me? And when he brought it, people said, this is stupid. This is ridiculous. The second year we were over there, I was kind of an intern. Like Sam Fiore, who our church supports, he was one of the ones, he did a lot of evangelization out in the street and preaching to hundreds of people. And I didn't know if I would ever know how to do that. I didn't know how to do it. I could never do something like that. But I went to the health department and asked them if they would give me somebody that in my neighborhood I could help. And they were like, what? And I mean, they didn't have that kind of stuff. But they gave me a guy in a housing project who lived with his mom and dad, and he had AIDS. And he was dying of AIDS because of heroin use that he had done. And so I started visiting him and becoming friends and just trying to reach out to him. And my colleague said, this is stupid. This is not how you're going to start a church. You're going to start a church with young families, with young kids. God did not send us here to do social work. And I remember reading in John chapter, in Romans chapter 12, where Paul says, present your body a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to him. And I was like, I gave myself, this is what I know to do. You think it's stupid, but Paul says it's holy. So there you go. there was a woman who poured out perfume on Jesus, and people said, this is stupid and it's a waste. And Jesus said, leave her alone. She's done a beautiful thing. There's a place in the book of Hebrews chapter 6. Says God is not unrighteous and will never forget the work, your work of faith and the love that you have shown to his name. And that you've ministered to the saints and you continue to do it. And he will never forget stuff you have long forgotten that you do. And he says it's beautiful. And so he took it. And I wasn't really prepared for this part. But he took the bread from Andrew and he broke it. And that's kind of what he does to you, is he will take you and he'll break you. And I'm like, why are you breaking me? And it's kind of that thing where you're like, I don't have what it takes to meet this need. And it's like, I'm glad you know that. You don't really know it well enough. And I need to teach you some more about that. You know, the first year we were over there, we were in a language school in Florence, Italy. And which is awesome and everything, but we were going to a school to learn the Italian language. And we had to walk over this, we'd go up these steel steps out of a park. It was about 45 feet tall. And then you'd walk over the steel bridge that went over about 20 railroad tracks because it was a passenger train station there. And then we would go down there. And on this bridge, every morning there was a lot of throw up. Like people had puked there. And I didn't really understand that. There was a lot of graffiti. We learned a lot of vocabulary words that there too on that part, but that we didn't learn in school. Roma, I won't say, but they. But the reason there was a lot of vomit is because there was a lot of heroin. And when people are addicted to heroin, they usually sleep outside, and they're often very sick. And we went to a school it is called Piazza Santo Spirito, a beautiful church where Michelangelo did his first dissections of human bodies and learned about how the human body is. And it was the first time I ever saw a person shoot up heroin in the open, just sitting on the steps of that church, and they would just do it in the open. And I was like, wow, I've never seen anything like that. And then when we moved to Milan's a city it's about the same size as Oak Ridge. Like if you go from Oklahoma Avenue to Elza Gate, it's about 10 miles. Milan is about 10 miles across and has 2.5 million people in it. And there were 10, 12 syringes filled with blood in our parking lot every day from heroin addicts that had used them during the night. And they're 99% HIV positive. And it's just like and there was a prostitute on every corner after 7 o'clock at night. One year we had 10 homicides within a mile of our apartment. And it was all just, mafia stuff and all of that. And we didn't know what to do. So we started to reach out to our neighbors. I was kind of an intern, and I had started working with that kid because I didn't know what else to do. And I knew all my other missionary friends, they were, preaching the gospel on the street, and I thought, I'll never do that. But we started reaching out to our neighbors. A guy named Ricardo and his wife named Luisa, and they had two girls, Francesca and another daughter. And we were just kind of got friends with them, and we were praying that we could share Jesus with them. And she had cancer, and we would eat at their house. They would eat at our house. And we got to where we would try to talk about Jesus and stuff. And they knew we loved the Lord, and they didn't know anything about Jesus. And her cancer got worse. And one night, they asked us if we could come over because they want to know what happens after a person died. And we were so excited, and we prayed. And when we went over there, at the right time, they were both really, really drunk. And, we tried as hard as we could, but they were drunk. And we tried to explain it as clearly as we could. And about 2 days later, Tina said, I need to go back and talk to Louisa. She was getting sick. And she went over that night. We prayed, and she went to talk with her. And while she was starting to talk, all of a sudden, a blood vessel in that lady's neck broke, and she started splurting blood. And Tina had to stop it, and they called 911 and everything like that. And she wasn't able to talk to her. And the next day she died. And we were like, and I was trying to reach out to this kid. And I would go to the hospital. I'd talked him into going to the hospital. And I knew all my colleagues were preaching out on the street and all that stuff. And I didn't know if I would ever do that. And I had kind of gotten to a place where Milan has, it's just when you go downtown, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And I went to Italy. We went to Italy. We just want to serve the Lord. And I realized that the need is that people were lost. And they needed to know about Jesus. And I didn't know how to do that. And I was very, very afraid. And I finally got to a place where in the spring, I couldn't go downtown because they were freaking me out. Because, I can't do this. I don't know how to share Jesus like that, with people, hundreds of people. I don't know how to do it. And I thought, And then Sam Fiore, the end of our second year, Sam Fiore was asking me to go with him. He already had a church of people he had led to Jesus, doing all this evangelization stuff. And he wanted me to join his team, and I could disciple guys that already came to know the Lord. Two other couples were going to start on the east end of town, and they did all that, going outside and sharing Jesus with people and hundreds of people listening to the gospel, and they wanted me to help them. And I thought, if I go with Sam and do that, it's because I'm afraid. And if I make my choices because I'm afraid, I need to go home. So I told these guys I would go with them. I don't know what we're going to do, and I don't have the stuff you want, but I'm going to go with them. And I knew that Sam, I was going to visit my guy on Friday afternoons and at the hospital. He was getting weaker and weaker. And the one Friday, that was my time to go. One Friday, I was going to visit him, and I was leaving my apartment, and I was waving to Tina in the fifth floor, and I turned, and a telephone pole hit me. I walked right into it, just like, bam! And I looked and see if anybody saw it. But then when I was supposed to go see Roberto, by that time, my pupils were different sizes. And I had the thing on my forehead like that. And I had a concussion. I wound up going to the ER and I didn't go. So I'd skip that Friday. The next Friday I was going to go. And his mother called me at 7 o'clock and she said he was dying and that we had to hurry. And I went and picked up his mother and we drove all the way to Niguata to the hospital. And when we got there, because we had talked a lot about Jesus, and he had said, I'll pray to receive Jesus, you know, and he didn't want to pray with me because he was embarrassed, but he said, I'll do it. When we got there, he was dead, and he had been dead for 15 minutes, and a priest had come along and had put his arms in his chest like this and put a cross there and had made a cross of oil and ashes on his forehead, and I was like, that's not right. You can't just do a little thing. You have to love someone. You have to love them and give your heart to them. And then you still don't know, and it's nothing. You know, and then if you feel like it's not, I don't even know what this is, what I did. You know, I tried, but I gave my heart to Jesus to help this person, and I don't even know if it did anything. And then I went, and I was so upset that he was dead, and I didn't know. And Sam Fiore was doing a big evangelization in Piazza Insubria, with music and all that stuff. And he was going to preach to hundreds. And I didn't know if I could do that. But I was so upset. And when I got there, he looked at me and he said, do you want to preach today? And I said, yes, I do. And I just told him about this kid and how he was gone. And I didn't know. And that everybody should know. And I don't know. Jesus, he took what people had given him. And he broke it. And then he multiplied it. And it never talks about that part. Like, what did he do? It doesn't say. But he met everybody's needs. And he'll take you, and then he'll break you. And then he'll use you to do things, and you don't even know how it happens. And that's how people know, you didn't do this. Jesus did it. I remember D.L. Moody saying, if there is an explanation for a work of God, it isn't one. It's just how he does. But he just says to you, would you just give yourself to me? I just want to use you in a world of endless need. Just give yourself to me. It might be tough, and I might break you in ways that you didn't expect. But I'm going to do things that you won't even realize I'm doing it. And that's the way he works. Anyway, he has the right to us. He gave his life and his body and his blood to give us a new life and so that we could be forgiven and to let us know how much he loves us. But also, it's just right to say, you've given everything to me. What I have left to myself, it's not much, and some people think it's a joke, but I give it to you in a world of endless need. It's nothing, but I want you to have it. And I think that if you would do that, and for people here that are doing it, he's using you in ways you'd never understand until it's all over with. Anyway, this is a time to come to remember how much he loved, how much he gave, how much he's loved you. And you don't have to be a member here. All we ask to come and take the bread and to remember the body and the blood that was given for us. We just ask that you know in your heart that you've accepted Jesus as your Savior and that you do love him. and just come and take care.
For more information about Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, including staff blogs, ministries we love and support, or just to connect with us, you can find us on the web at c3oakridge.org.